It tastes like a dark chocolate with cayenne or caspasin.
Yeah, perfect. That's exactly what it was.
Well, there you go then.
You do research on enterochromaffin cells, and mm-hmm. a lot of the things that these enterochromaffin cells sense are irritants. Mm-hmm. The spiciness in the chocolate was kind of used to mix up with the sweetness of the chocolate that normally is there to give that kind of conflicting message to the enterochromaffin cell.
Squirrels and other rodents are smart enough to sample and then avoid this when hot peppers. But people were kind of dumb about it, and we're like, we like that. We're going to have some more. Huh. So that's what we did.
Yeah, and that's why we put it in our chocolate.
That's why we put it in our chocolate.
Hi, and welcome back to the Gastronauts Podcast. My name is Peter, and I'll be your host. Here at Gastronauts, we are committed to exploring communication throughout the body with a focus on the crosstalk between gut and brain. We invite experts in this field to share both their research and their journeys. So come join me as we explore the steps that go into shaping a scientist on the Gastronauts Podcast. Today, we have Dr. Jim Byra, an assistant professor and pediatric gastroenterologist at the University of California, San Francisco. He completed his MD and PhDs at Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine. At Case Western, he studied the specific structure and function of proteins involved in sex determination in the laboratory of Dr. Michael Weiss. Upon finishing his PhD, he traveled out west to California for residency in pediatrics at UCSF. He stayed on to do a fellowship in gastroenterology, where he took care of children with digestive, pancreatic, and liver conditions. And as a fellow, he also did some research with Dr. Robert Fleiderek and Dr. Holly Ingram to study the factors involved in colon cancer development. He has really taken advantage of organoids as a model system. And these organoids are a really neat system that display the shape and morphology of our gut, but can be studied outside of our body in a culture dish. Dr. Byra has studied enterochromaffin cells, which are rare serotonin-secreting cells in these organoids, to develop a better understanding of our visceral or internal sense of pain. So I want to start by taking a trip down memory lane with you. When you were at Case Western, what drew you to studying sex determinations in fruit flies, and how did that inform your decision to pursue a residency in pediatrics? They seem a little bit disparate to me, but I was wondering what was going through your head at the time.
Thanks for having me. So that's an interesting question, and yeah, the sex determination and crystallography is pretty far removed from what I've been doing lately. But what drew me to study this was the idea that the structure of a protein can really dictate its function. And so in Drosophila, sex is determined by this gene that I was studying called double sex. Mm-hmm. And I was curious as to how the structures that the female or the male-specific sequences change the function that would give you such dramatically different phenotype and development. So it really goes back to more of an interest in structure and function and protein biochemistry.
Yeah. And development as well, correct? Mm-hmm. Did that have any influence on your decision to pursue a career in pediatrics, or were the two kind of separate ideas in your head at that time?
The two were separate. Mm-hmm. And so when I was training in the PhD phase of my work, I knew that I was going to subspecialize into something, and what that was going to be, I wasn't entirely sure. Mm-hmm. I still had an interest in protein interactions and structural biology, which is pretty general and can be applied across all of the disciplines in medicine. And so what really convinced me to do pediatrics was actually when I went back as a third-year medical student and started my clerkship rotations. Yeah. And I started out with pediatrics, and I fell in love with both the patient populations and working with the families and the children, but also the relationships that you can develop in the long-term care mm-hmm. of these families with complex medical issues. I found that to be a very rewarding side of medicine. And the other thing that I thought was really interesting in pediatrics is that somebody could come with you with a certain set of symptoms. And depending on the age of the patient, you could have a very, very different differential diagnosis.
Right.
And so in many ways, it kind of ticked those boxes of clinical thought process and puzzle solving that makes medicine a lot of fun. And it just adds that extra layer of complexity to the process.
Yeah, that's really neat. Do you feel like your time away from your PhD to when you started doing research again in your fellow years while you were kind of a third and fourth year medical student while you were pursuing your residency in pediatrics, has that influenced or framed how you think of research or changed how your thought process mm-hmm. of research was?
Yeah, and so the intervening time, right, is really a time that I focused on my clinical skills and to try and hone those to be the best clinician that I could be.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really focused on that. But at the same time, the farther and farther away from the basic bench and the exciting, you know, bench research that I could do, the more I really did start to miss it and mm-hmm. to be able to ask a fundamental question, be able to answer it. And so what I would say is that clinical time served to help me focus my research questions on work that is more directly applicable to the patients that I care about and that I'm treating. That's probably the biggest takeaway that I had in terms of my clinical experience informing the research.
Right. Do you mind telling me a little bit more about your current research efforts?
Yeah, so our lab has mainly two projects with some overlap. And one side of that is based around epithelial regeneration and differentiation. And so what programs are there that help control this normal process where the gut intestine lining is renewed every week or so
mm-hmm.
and helps control the proper distribution of the specialized sensory cells and other cells that compose the lining of the gut? So that's one side of the lab. And then the other side of the lab is a collaborative effort with a number of really fantastic investigators looking at the signaling side and the signal integration processing. And so that's the sensory visceral pain aspect to the research. So we have one side that's really organoid and developmental biology focused, and then another side that's more physiology focused.
Do you see kind of the organoid and developmental biology influencing or having an impact on the clinic? What kind of diseases are there mm-hmm. that we know of in pediatric populations where there are kind of developmental or programming issues with our intestinal cells?
So there are an increasingly recognized number of genes involved in epithelial, both renewal as well as barrier formation, that have been implicated in our very early onset IBD patient population.
And IBD stands for inflammatory bowel disease.
That's right. These patients are diagnosed between 0 and 5 years of age with inflammatory bowel disease. And we now have the tools to be able to try and identify genetic causes that we can intervene on specifically. And that's one major aspect. In terms of organoid, one of the other things that's been really interesting is actually cystic fibrosis. We think about cystic fibrosis mainly in terms of pulmonary disease, right? Because that's what really drives the clinical morbidity and mortality.
Mm-hmm.
But when you take a step back and look, you realize that the transmembrane protein that's mutated in cystic fibrosis is expressed throughout the GI tract as well. And so there's liver disease, pancreatic disease, as well as intestinal disease.
Right.
In cystic fibrosis, there have been a number of really game-changing medications that have come to market. And when you look at trying to match those drugs with a particular type of mutation, going to trials, the drugs are really targeted to a particular mutation. What we don't know from the clinical trials is if drug X is going to work with mutation Y or mutation Z if it's only been studied for mutation A.
Mm.
And what was figured out is that if you make organoids from cystic fibrosis patients, you can stimulate those organoids with fosgolin. And a functioning CFTR will allow those organoids to swell due to flux of the ion channel opener.
So this essentially allows a kind of a high-throughput readout.
That's right. Okay. And even more importantly, it allows you to do a personalized medicine approach. And so now you can take an organoid from a cystic fibrosis patient, you can expose it to different potential medications, and find out very quickly if their particular CF mutation is going to respond to that drug.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, that's really revolutionized the ability to match the right patient with the right drug, which is really that basis of precision medicine.
And I think the field of organoids has really taken off because it is more similar to what we see kind of in our living tissue. What drew you initially to the field of organoids? I noticed you previously kind of did a lot of structure-function relationships, but what drew you to the cell culture and organoids in particular?
I became really enamored with a particular nuclear receptor that was expressed in the liver, in the pancreas, as well as in the intestine, and began to think about that first from a structural biology aspect, because I was interested in potentially drugging the receptor to tune activity either up or down. And as I was going through the biochemistry of that, I started to become really interested in the underlying biology. So at that point, I realized that I needed to add some skills to my experimental toolkit in order to be able to answer some bigger questions about how the receptor is functioning overall in the tissue. That's what really led me to being able to do organoids. And so I had a collaborative research experience with Ophir Klein's lab at UCSF, who had at the time recently brought in the organoids and technology. That enabled me to have support from an established stem cell investigator to kind of teach me the ropes in terms of using this technology to be able to get at those questions about cell renewal and differentiation.
Right. Cystic fibrosis is typically looked at as a gene mutation, and the pathology is typically seen kind of within the lungs or skin as well. Why use an organoid from the intestine as opposed to an organoid from the lung to test this? Mm-hmm. Is it just because of the ease of grabbing the tissue?
So patients with cystic fibrosis do have intestinal dysmotility, and it's thought to be primarily due to problems with secretion. And so there are a number of GI issues that we co-manage with our pediatric pulmonologists. But to directly answer your question, it's entirely expediency to do a rectal biopsy to obtain tissue to do an organoid. Can be done even without sedation. It's very, very quick. It's a painless procedure. Whereas to take lung tissue is much, much, much more involved. And so it really just became fundamentally easier and faster.
That's really neat. The first thing that came to my mind when you were telling me about inflammatory bowel disease is that we tend to delineate it into two types, Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. Mm-hmm. As I learn more about the two pathologies, it most likely lies among a spectrum. Do you feel like this organoid approach will help us better classify different types of inflammatory bowel disease? And do you think ultimately there will be a treatment that is targeted to specific subsets of these groups?
Yeah, so certainly. So my feeling is that inflammatory bowel disease is a spectrum of probably 100 or 200 different things that all are essentially phenocopies that we have binned somewhat artificially into ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, or indeterminate colitis. And it's been clear from the sequencing approaches that there are mutations associated with disease both in the intestinal epithelium as well as within the immune system. We know also that microbiome can play a part in disease pathogenesis and propagation. I think that it's vast oversimplification that we've done. But at the end of the day, did we ask, does for the current treatments that are available, did that simplification work? Well, kind of, you know, so we make a big deal trying to distinguish between Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, and then we end up treating them the same about half the time. And so there is definitely a need to be able to really separate out distinct pathophysiologic mechanisms so that we can, like the CF analogy, be able to really target the right medication to the right pathophysiology. I think that organoids will be a part of that, and to some extent they already are. And so it's really going to be figuring out where we can use the organoids, where we have to use our other systems. But at the end of the day, I think that we're going to end up with, you know, thousands and thousands of patients with IBD with sequencing, and then it's going to be figuring out how can we can separate the signal from the noise and understand what variants we're seeing are actually disease-related and how we're going to address those with medications to put the disease into remission.
Right. I wanted to segue a little bit into the other aspect of your lab, the visceral sensing component of it. Mm-hmm. And by visceral sensing, we mean kind of this internal pain that we don't really classify with kind of the same type of pain that we have when we have like a cut or a wound. This is so different from inflammatory bowel disease, where we do have somewhat of a regimented treatment plan for how we treat inflammatory bowel disease compared to irritable bowel syndrome, which is a common syndrome associated with visceral pain. And I was wondering your thoughts on A, kind of what our research efforts are, or what your research efforts are, and B, what kind of therapeutics you think we'll be able to develop for IBS.
So our lab has been really interested in the enterochromaffin cell, which is the serotonin-producing cell within the lining of the gut. These cells, they represent about 1% of the epithelial cells, but they're responsible for about 90% of the body's serotonin production. So these are major neurotransmitter factories throughout the lining of the gut. Mm-hmm. And we became interested in understanding what makes them tick and how they're working. Mm-hmm. And so we incorporated the organoids to be able to have these enterochromaffin cells in as native an environment as possible, but still accessible for excitation studies. And so to be able to really understand what types of signals they respond to. And then the next aspect they were interested in is what happens to that serotonin. And so is this a humoral thing? Is this paracrine, autocrine? Is it?
And these are all different ways that serotonin is being secreted, either through the blood or to nearby neurons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Exactly. We asked where the serotonin receptor-expressing neurons lie in relation to the enterochromaffin cell, and found that they do traverse right underneath these enterochromaffin cells. Yeah. And so then that allowed us to ask whether or not these are forming a synapse-like connection. And so is this really a direct talking of the enterochromaffin cell to the nerve fiber itself?
And these enterochromaffin cells respond to both mechanical and chemical stimulants?
Yeah, and so we've looked at the chemical response to these and showed that, you know, if you stimulate the EC cell, you increase nerve firing, you know, immediately in the associated fiber, and that this can be blocked either by using agents that block EC cell activity or agents that block the nerve fiber. The beta group at Mayo has looked at mechanical sensitivity and looking at PaSO2 expression within enterochromaffin cells. I guess to oversimplify, you're poking it with a stick, but they're using a really fine technique to apply gradients of mechanical pressure to the enterochromaffin cells, either in isolation or as part of an organoid, and seeing that the mechanical pressure does also causes depolarization and releases serotonin from the cells. And so then you can say that, yeah, it looks like there's both mechanical and chemosensory effects.
For me, it's easier to intuitively understand the space that mechanical sensation occupies, in the sense that it can feel a certain amount of force. Mm-hmm. But the chemical space is much larger. Do we have any idea of what compounds activate enterochromaffin cells? Do they respond to all types of food? Do they respond to all types of microbial metabolites? Do they respond to the bacteria in our gut? Is there any discrimination, or has it been shown that enterochromaffin cells kind of respond to all of these stimuli? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we found that there are specific receptors for specific targets in the enterochromaffin cells, and you can kind of lump these things into three main categories. And so they respond to irritants. The real pungent substance that's found in garlic or wasabi triggers them. Various short-chain fatty acids, which we tend to think of as microbial byproducts, and in particular, isovalerate was a very strong activator of enterochromaffin cells, and that's the short-chain fatty acid that gives gym socks or stinky cheese their particular odor. And then catecholamines also activated these cells quite strongly. Mm-hmm. That was done on a relatively limited survey of things that we thought could potentially be activating these cells. Mm-hmm. It's possible that we've missed whole categories, mm-hmm. but we thought that was a pretty good start. And when we think about the things that activate the EC cells, then those are all potentially all seem to have the same common theme of, you know, maybe there's danger in this luminal inside gut environment. And given the importance of serotonin in secretion and motility, maybe a way to for that the GI tract can protect itself when it senses essentially luminal danger.
Yeah, really neat. And then the other aspect is these are serotonin secreting cells. And you touched upon this earlier, whether it's humoral, whether it's paracrine. Do you have kind of a framework or an idea of how you think the serotonin is being transmitted?
We're particularly interested in serotonin released into one of these synaptic-like connections. you know, what we saw is when we activate the EC cells that we can elicit a mechanical hypersensitivity in the attached afferent nerve fibers. Okay. And so what that implies to us is that this may be partially a mechanism to explain increased gut pain in a patient with IBS relative to somebody without. When we think about IBS and where in enterochromaffin cells, there's been some prior work looking at the number of enterochromaffin cells that appear to be potentially increased in some patients with IBS, suggesting that maybe they have even more of a serotonin input. And there have also been some studies that suggest that during estrus cycle that there's changes in the amount of serotonin produced in EC cells, or maybe even a change in EC cell number themselves. Mm-hmm. And when we think about conditions like IBS, there's about a threefold increase in females compared to males. So there's definitely a biological sex-based difference here that is reflected in the serotonin and is also reflected in disease pathology. And so the question is, well, is this also related? And so some of the work that we're doing now is to really try and map out these connections between the enterochromaffin cells and their associated nerve fibers, as well as to engineer activity, so to activate or deactivate enterochromaffin cells, and ask how that affects the perception of visceral pain in our rodent models.
I'm really excited to see some of the work that comes out of your lab to study this. I want to transition a little bit more to kind of your career. I was talking to a colleague here at Duke previously, and he told me that no stage in his career really prepared him for the next stage of his career. Can you tell me some more about some of the challenges that you hadn't anticipated transitioning from kind of a fellow to an assistant professor?
I was really blessed with a very supportive division and supportive mentors. So I think that that actually was really nice about my environment, particularly where I trained. I think probably one of the biggest difficulties is figuring out how to manage your time. You're working on your independence for both your research career, but at the same time, now you're an attending physician and you're responsible for an awful lot of patient care. It's trying to being able to balance those two worlds so that you're providing optimal care to your patients, so you're not letting people down. But at the same time, you're really jealously guarding your time so that you can be productive in the lab and prepare yourself for the next stage after that, which is the independent investigator stage.
Yeah. Being a physician is a full-time job. Being a professor is a full-time job as well. And how do you manage to put both of those in? Are there some things that you have to compromise on, or do you feel like there are some things that you've given away a little bit?
Yeah, and so I've certainly pulled back from the number of patients that I see. You know, if I'm out traveling, I feel it's not entirely fair to my patients for them to not be able to find an appointment for me for, like, you know, 5 months. You know, that's not so good. Moving towards systems of working within the pediatric fellowship training program to work in teaching clinic situations, and so have patient care there, but also be working with a larger team of physicians so that if I'm not around, somebody else who knows the patient and is involved in the care is around, and so we can always make sure that we're delivering the care to the patient that we need. That's probably been the biggest change and the biggest pullback that I've had from my regular kind of fellowship years to where I am now.
It's a dependence on a team. It's a team effort, and that's something you've reiterated before and something that you continue to impress. Mm-hmm. You are also the assistant fellowship director at UCSF. What do you feel this role has taught you about yourself, and what are you hoping to instill in kind of your trainees or your fellows at this point?
In terms of what it's taught about myself, I think it really reiterated that I very much enjoy teaching, and I enjoy working with learners in a complicated academic environment where we can really sit and think about problems, think about solutions for patients if I'm in the patient setting, or challenging hypotheses or research plans if we're in the basic science setting. Mm-hmm. It's actually been a real lot of fun working with our fellows as they go through this really intensive period of training. Mm-hmm. And come in on one side has graduating pediatric residents, And then Leaf, 3 or 4 years later, has, you know, gastroenterology specialists and academicians. And that's been a very fulfilling part of my job.
And when you are training some of these fellows, do you feel like there are some common mistakes or challenges or growth opportunities that you notice? And I don't know, when you reflect on your own time as a fellow, are these things that you have also recognized?
I think the biggest thing is just how quickly time goes by and how much of a compressed timeline you're on as a fellow. And especially if you're interested in developing an academic research career, there, if you don't have as much of a baseline background in doing science, it takes a good effort to really get up to speed. Mm-hmm. And so it's really stopping and thinking, counting back even at the end of your first year, say, all right, so by X many months, you need to be kind of this far along so that you can have an application, because that NIH application isn't going to be reviewed for, you know, like 4 months after you put it in, and then if you anticipate another submission. And so all of a sudden, you're building in a year and a half time before you would know if you're going to get a grant or not as a junior faculty. And so the timing is, I think, one of the biggest surprises for our fellows.
Yeah. And do you feel like the timing, or there's a pressure kind of with regards to time as you're starting up your own lab? Do you feel the similar time crunch or not so much?
Yeah, I think that it's fair. I think everybody feels kind of that pressure. I think there's always that pressure. Again, I've been lucky in that the environment that I've been in has been very supportive, and you know, working with David and Holly and Stu on this collaborative environment has also given me access to additional resources that, I didn't foresee myself having even a few years ago, as I was looking more staying more on the epithelial side of things. So I think that's been a real leg up.
Sounds like you've had some really great mentors. And I was wondering, as you're looking to build your team, what are you looking for in mentees?
Mm-hmm. So I think the biggest thing that I want that I look for is curiosity and a drive to answer questions. Mm-hmm. And so to have people that, you know, they're excited to come in and to think about a problem and to think big about a problem, not being afraid to fail at it, as long as, you know, you're learning a lesson from the work and the process. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the big things that I look for. And then the other thing is somebody that works well in a collaborative team environment. In many ways, what I'm looking for in somebody coming into the lab is the same thing that I'm looking for in somebody coming into our fellowship program. Mm-hmm. We've got a lot of folks that we've had real success with in training in you know, active research environment. Mm-hmm. And with a wide variety of backgrounds. Again, I think that those key qualities are ones that they don't necessarily show up on a research pedigree of, you know, I went to Harvard, Yale, Duke, wherever, but rather that they really come across in how that person approaches science.
Do you feel that a lot of the skills to be successful in medicine are the same as the skills that are necessary to be successful in research?
I think so. So there, medicine, a large part of medicine is really about pattern recognition.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to separate that signal from the noise. And so when you've got a panel of lab tests coming back and somebody who has a whole bunch of different somatic complaints, but figuring out like what's really the heart of the matter.
Mm-hmm.
That pattern recognition also plays a role in science, right? When you're looking through your data, and sometimes you just have noise in there, and sometimes you have a real signal. So being able to identify that signal and go with it. And so I think that those are two that are things that are very, very similar. Yeah. I think certainly curiosity is important in medicine, and so particularly at large academic centers where people coming in are not necessarily coming in with your garden variety problems, to really be able to think like, all right, well, what else is going on in here, and what tests do I need to do, or what history questions do I need to ask that will really allow me to get to the heart of what's bothering this patient. I think that, yeah, there's an awful lot of overlap At the same time, there's also a real distinction in the time course of decision-making.
Yeah.
Right? If you're thinking about your lab experiment and you're trying to get the best controls because, you know, you're going to send out this $30,000 single-cell RNA-seq data set adventure and, like, boy, you better make sure you got everything absolutely correct on that. You know, and you've got some luxury of time where you can sit and you can think about that for a week or so. Mm-hmm. You don't always have that luxury. And so the PhD, you can gather a lot more information and really feel like you're making an informed decision. Mm-hmm. In medicine, sometimes you're operating on really imperfect data. Mm-hmm. And you just have to acknowledge, all right, this is imperfect data, and I may be wrong, but I'm going to have to go with the best guess because, you know, we don't really have a lot of extra time to figure this out.
Speaking of this concept of time, I was wondering, where would you like to see the field of gastroenterology in 10 years?
You know, I think right now we're really at a golden age of a nexus between being able to have epithelial biology, neuronal microbiome, and immune response systems all coming together and having the tools to be able to dissect and try and understand what the inputs and the outputs from each of these systems are and how they work with each other. Mm-hmm. So in 10 years, you know, I'd like to know that we've been able to map out some of the sensory systems and get a handle on the pathways that are involved in the problems that really affect activities of daily life for people, so the chronic pain issues. So can we figure out what some of these pathways are so that we can target some treatments? And, you know, in 10 years, I'd like to be able to say that, yeah, we finally have a medication that can help, or a therapy plan that can really benefit somebody with my really severe IBS and get them so that they can pursue the things that they want to do.
Really neat. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Of course, thank you.
Dr. Byra took us from bench to bedside and really focused on how he sees these intestinal organoid models being incorporated in the diagnosis of disease. He underscored the importance of improving our time management during each phase of our career, and that's something I hope we all take the time to think about. How can we make sure we are being both rigorous and efficient? And I'll leave you with that thought. I want to thank you all so much for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode. For more of our content, you can follow us on Twitter at GutBrains or visit our website at thinkgastronauts.com. The Gastronauts podcast would be impossible without our incredible team. Meredith Schmell is our producer and theme music composer. And special thanks to the founders of Gastronauts, Dr. Diego Borges and the Borges Laboratory.